Welcome to Hour 1 of the Arizona Republic for Thursday, July 30th. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer, Jack Palmer, reading international, national, and local news in USA Today headlines. The first article is titled, Fauci Pleads Fifth at Tense Hearing, written by Bart Jansen, Joey Garrison, and Aaron Mansfield. Dr. Anthony Fauci may be held in contempt after refusing to answer Republicans' questions about the origins of COVID-19 as he sat in a witness chair invoking the Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination. The former head of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases under seven presidents appeared under subpoena July 29th before the Senate Committee on Homeland Security and Government Affairs. Over and over, Fauci repeated, "On the advice of counsel, I respectfully decline to answer based on my rights under the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution." The hearing became so tense that Senator Rand Paul, the Kentucky Republican who chairs the committee, and who for years has accused Fauci of covering up the origin of the coronavirus, had one of Fauci's lawyers ejected from the room for sitting next to him at the witness table. Paul said a Senate panel will hold a vote next week on whether to hold Fauci in contempt. He said Fauci should have testified because President Joe Biden issued him a preemptive pardon. "It's against the law to obstruct an investigation of Congress," Paul said. "There will be repercussions." Fauci, now 85, was the public face of the federal government's response to the COVID-19 pandemic. He retired from federal government work at the end of 2022. Paul said if Fauci purges himself, the pardon for past actions won't protect him. Reading from a one-page statement at the start of the hearing, Fauci said he would be invoking his Fifth Amendment right because the hearing had one purpose: to entrap him into saying something that could potentially be used against him in court. He said Paul had an unhinged obsession with prosecuting him. He cited repeated slanderous comments about me and Paul's recent release of Fauci's diary aimed at embarrassing and intimidating me. "The only conclusion I can reach is that the sole reason he is calling me before this committee is to get me to say something, anything, that could vindicate his repeated public pledges that I end up, in his words, behind bars," Fauci said. Paul said he denied Fauci's assertion of privilege and directed him to answer questions anyway. Paul said the funding for experimental research at the lab was one of the worst public health decisions in history, and said Fauci needed to come clean and ask forgiveness from the American people who suffered as the coronavirus spread to pandemic proportions. He peppered Fauci with questions about Mpox research, the possible CIA transfer of funds to his agency, and research into how avian flu jumped to mammals. Paul focused on whether the benefits of the research into how viruses are spread were worth the risk. Republicans on the committee used the hearing to air some of their long-held claims about him and his medical advice to Americans, using Fauci's Fifth Amendment strategy in an attempt to shame the infectious disease expert. "We have entire generations of Americans who, rightfully so, do not trust our institutions to keep them safe because of you," Senator Rick Scott of Florida told Fauci. This has destroyed decades of progress and lifetimes of work because you wanted to fuel your own ego and be the center of attention. In hindsight, are you disappointed how you handled COVID? Do you have any regrets? Scott asked in another exchange. Fauci gave his standard answer. Your legacy will not be as a man who has saved America from COVID, but as a man who destroyed the public trust in America's public health institutions in exchange for 5 minutes of fame, Scott said. This is how history will remember you. Senator Josh Hawley, Republican of Missouri, began with, "Nothing says honesty like taking the fifth, huh, Doc?" He then mocked Fauci's strategy by asking him a series of basic factual questions about the day of the week and the color of the carpet. To each, Fauci said, "On the advice of counsel, I respectfully decline to answer based on my rights under the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution." Hawley accused Fauci of violating the law and said he's done more to harm science than anybody in my lifetime. "I hope you'll go home and write that in your diary," he added. Several Democratic senators came to Fauci's defense. Senator Maggie Hassan, Democrat of New Hampshire, thanked Fauci for more than 50 years of federal government service and said, "It must be enormously frustrating to know that this hearing is designed to entrap you." She lamented the spread of public health crises such as measles and cyclosporiasis. Senator Richard Blumenthal, Democrat of Connecticut, said the COVID-19 pandemic was one of the darkest times in U.S. history and suggested the hearing was part of the Trump administration's efforts to rewrite the history of a pandemic. The Trump administration launched baseless smears against vaccines that pulled the country out of the crisis that killed 1 million Americans and 15 million people worldwide. Blumenthal said, "Fauci spent decades in federal government helping conquer COVID-19, HIV, swine flu, Zika, Ebola, and other epidemics," he said. "For the past 18 months, the Trump administration has been engaged in a campaign to rewrite this history," Blumenthal said. "Today's proceeding, I fear, is part of that effort, one of the darkest days in our Senate's history." After roughly 3 hours of questioning, Paul closed the hearing by arguing that Fauci abused his power at the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases and helped fund research that led to the largest man-made plague in human history. Fauci was then escorted out by police, walking past reporters shouting questions in the hallway without answering. He may face a similar panel in the House. As the hearing ended, Representative James Comer, Republican of Kentucky and chair of the Oversight and Government Reform Committee, threatened to subpoena Fauci as well. The next article is titled, "Testimony Gives Rare Insight into ICE Tactics," written by David Ulloa. Several SUVs rolled into the parking lot of a Home Depot in West Phoenix. The people in the SUVs were not there to shop. They were U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents conducting a secretive undercover operation to find customers in the country illegally. It was around 10 a.m. on January 29th. The agents sat in their vehicles in the parking lot, punching the license plates into computers and then running the owners' names to see if they showed up on any immigration databases. They were looking for people who previously had been ordered deported or had other immigration violations. Then the agents swooped into action. The little-known tactic of staking out Home Depot parking lots, which has happened with increasing frequency during the Trump administration's mass deportation campaign in Phoenix and other cities, was revealed in a federal courtroom in Phoenix during the criminal trial of a man who was arrested for assaulting one of the agents attempting to detain his father. A jury found the man, Isaac Luis Azamar, not guilty on July 16th. Immigrant advocates have widely criticized the tactics, but according to immigration and civil rights attorneys interviewed by the Arizona Republic, the tactics are not illegal. But they raise numerous concerns, including that federal agents are devoting resources to go after ordinary workers rather than dangerous criminals. You almost feel there could be better resources used for people who are actually committing crimes versus just driving down the road, just running people's plates randomly, said Benjamin Taylor, a civil rights attorney based in Arizona. The testimony also came as the Trump administration overturned a July 14th ICE memo that ordered its officers to scale back traffic stops after a backlash when two immigrants were killed during traffic stops, and as a growing number of Americans felt compelled to carry U.S. citizenship documents after a Supreme Court ruling in September 2025. The Supreme Court gave the green light to federal immigration enforcement authorities to use factors such as a person's race or ethnicity, speaking Spanish or English with an accent, their type of work, and presence in a particular location to stop and question them. Fernando Burgos, an ICE spokesperson, said in a brief written statement that ICE does not disclose or discuss law enforcement tactics or capabilities details. We are always evaluating our procedures to keep our officers safe and criminals off the street. ICE officers Todd Glunt, Justin McNeil, Sean Peckroll, and Brandon Lee Easton started their January 29th shift in the early morning, around 5, when it was still dark, according to their testimonies. They were part of a mobile criminal apprehension team tasked with finding and detaining people who were in the country illegally, Easton said. After conducting a targeted immigration enforcement operation earlier in their shift, the officers discreetly rolled into the Home Depot on 43rd Avenue and Camelback Road around 10 a.m. They parked their unmarked SUVs far from the entrance, but not to keep the vehicles from getting scratched, according to Peckroll and Easton's testimonies. They went to the Home Depot to run the plates of vehicles they suspected of belonging to undocumented people, Peckroll said under questioning from a government attorney. That included vehicles with roof racks, expired tags, and temporary license plates, he said. Officers hid their vehicle so they could not be identified as law enforcement by day laborers and customers who patronized the store, Easton said, under questioning from Debbie Jang, the public defender representing Luis Azamar. When the officers got to Home Depot, they did not have a specific target, Peckroll said. He clarified to the jury that the term target is used by ICE to describe people with criminal histories and people who are in the country illegally. As McNeil sat in his vehicle, he entered the license plate numbers into a database that provided information on the vehicle's owner, the owner's license history, the vehicle's registration and tag history, McNeil said. The database also provided the name of the vehicle's owner, the owner's birth date, their gender, and driver's license history, he said. McNeil was looking for suspicious irregularities in the vehicle and vehicle owner information. If McNeil found anything that looked out of the ordinary, he ran the owner's name through a separate database that showed if the owner had been deported or if they had an order for removal, he said. McNeil described it as one system with multiple databases. It's unknown how many vehicle plates McNeil ran that day. However, McNeil said he eventually radioed the other officers that he found one that looked good, meaning he found a vehicle that belonged to an undocumented vehicle owner. The truck that looked good belonged to Castro Silvas, and the driver was Louis Azamar. There were no issues with Castro Silas's vehicle registration history, McNeil said. Louis Azamar had car insurance and he was not speeding, Louis Azamar told the jury during his testimony. Pecrol said Castro Silas's truck and name were run through their databases because of the condition the vehicle was in that made it suspicious. The specific details of the event leading up to the detainment of Louis Azamar and Castro Silas were disputed by the public defender and government attorneys during the trial. Both father and son were detained by immigration enforcement officers after they were followed from the Home Depot parking lot. Greg Frey, a Phoenix-based immigration attorney and vice chair of the Arizona chapter of the American Immigration Lawyers Association, said he has seen more and more cases of immigration enforcement being carried out by mobile criminal apprehension teams. Through immigration court and ICE documents that describe the events of their operations, Frey has also seen more cases of ICE using tactics like scanning license plates, he said. I think we're still very much learning about what these new enforcement operations entail and whether or not they are complying with the law, Frey said. In some cases, immigration laws do allow for warrantless arrests, but it is restricted, Frey said. It's lawful but awful, Taylor said. ICE, like other law enforcement agencies, is also allowed to scan license plates and check if people are driving with a suspended license, Taylor said. In accordance with federal and state law, the Arizona Department of Transportation Motor Vehicle Division provides the Arizona Department of Public Safety with access to vehicle data, said Bill Lamoureux, an ADOT spokesperson. DPS manages the Arizona Criminal Justice Information System, but any law enforcement agency can access Arizona motor vehicle registration information for law enforcement purposes, Lamoureux said. It's lawful for any police department, local and federal, to read and run license plates to see if you are legally allowed to drive, Taylor said. But it's kind of awful as a practice of just trying to pull people over and trying to get people without them committing a crime or any sort of traffic violation, Taylor added. People in the United States, whether they are U.S. citizens or undocumented, are entitled to their Fourth and Fifth Amendment rights, Taylor said. Azumar got some justice when he was acquitted of assault on a federal officer, but Castro Silas did not, said Salvador Reza, a longtime immigrant rights activist. The father didn't get any justice. The father is basically out of here, and even though he probably was here for a long time, he has to go back to restart his life at a later age, which is hard, Reza said. Reza is glad Azumar was acquitted, but said this does not resolve the problem of indiscriminate detainment of day laborers. Every time they pick up a day laborer, every time they pick up a landscaper, every time they pick up a roofer, you are diminishing the economy of the United States, Reza said. Reza warned that the detainment of day laborers will not only affect the construction industry, but will also affect individuals, especially the elderly, who might rely on their labor. They're the ones everybody picks off, but they're the ones that mainly make the United States economy run, so it's sad, Reza said. Reza said the tactics used by ICE are a form of profiling. A rack on top of a vehicle does not necessarily mean a person is undocumented, but they're profiling, Reza said. Despite the risk of being profiled, laborers will continue working, Reza added. They have to work, and they're not going to stop working because they need to work, but they have to prepare themselves, Reza said. Reza recommended people have an emergency plan in the event a loved one is detained, with contingency plans such as who will care for their children. The next article is titled, State Representative Heap, Public Financing is at Risk After Election Query, written by Elena Mensinger. An Arizona Corporation Commission candidate is at risk of disqualification from a public campaign financing program, according to an email obtained by the Arizona Republic in a records request. State Representative Ralph Heap, on July 20th, qualified for public financing through the Citizens Clean Elections Program, records show. The next day, the Republican challenger bested incumbent Nick Myers in a close primary race. But just a few days after Heap's win at the polls, Citizens Clean Elections Commission Executive Director Tom Collins delivered bad news. There was substantial evidence that Heap's campaign finance reports didn't fully reflect the cost or the funding source of campaign signs supporting the Turning Point endorsed candidate, Collins wrote in an email to the candidate's legal counsel. Meanwhile, Heap's financing from Clean Elections is on ice for other reasons. The program is waiting for him to submit a statement validating the accuracy of his campaign finance reports before releasing funds. Unless Heap withdraws from the program, he is also prohibited from raising private money while the public dollars are held up. Lisa Everett, a Republican organizer and candidate for Dysart Unified School District School Board, filed a complaint about what she felt were discrepancies between the number of signs supporting Heap versus the spending indicated in his campaign finance reports, which show an expenditure of roughly $650 on signs at a local sign shop. Another line item shows a little over $262 spent at a print shop on communications advertising, although the medium of the advertising is unclear. A spokesperson for Democrat candidates Clara Prate and Jonathan Hill confirmed the two candidates spent more than $41,000 each on printing and installing 600 large double-sided street signs and rebar, but noted the cost might be slightly higher than average because the campaign used a union print shop. Myers told the Arizona Republic that he and fellow incumbent Kevin Thompson reused large street signs from the 2022 election, but spent roughly $5,000 to print 1,000 smaller yard signs. Heap did not return calls from the Arizona Republic on Monday and Tuesday. In a brief response letter dated July 27th, Heap's attorney wrote that he was still reviewing the complaint and currently is unable to concede the allegations in the complaint letter. Attorney Tim Lasota did not return the Republic's request for further comment. Everett, a supporter of Myers and Thompson, said she took notice of Heap's large street signs around the Phoenix Metro. Even on a trip to Flagstaff, Everett said Heap's signs lined the streets. Interested in the funding source, Everett pulled up Heap's campaign finance report. "This doesn't add up," she recalled thinking, seeing just a small amount spent on signs. Everett wrote in the complaint that she had been unable to determine how the printing and installation of the signs was paid for, likely a significant sum for Heap's campaign. Over the past week, Everett said she's noticed that many of Heap's signs around the West Valley have been taken down. Myers said he 100% thinks the signs made a difference in the July primary. Another clean elections candidate, Myers said he and Thompson couldn't access the majority of their funding until qualifying for public financing. The two candidates had volunteers install old signs from the 2022 election before printing a couple batches of smaller yard signs. "So he had his out months before we did," Myers said, "and that name recognition definitely plays a part." Myers said Heap told him at an event earlier this year that he had bought roughly 1,000 signs. Myers said following controversies over utilities trying to move the needle on Arizona Corporation Commission candidates and the creation of a new ethics code for commissioners, candidates for the powerful regulatory board typically pursue public financing. "It's difficult to seek outside donations for the regulatory board besides insiders. Self-funding," Myers said, "can also be dicey if any of the candidates' income comes from utility stocks or similar sources. To get funding for a no-name office like the Corporation Commission is just next to impossible without going to the utility, and that's just not appropriate," Myers said. "Going the clean elections route cuts the drama," Myers added. "It trades it for other drama, as you can tell," Myers said. "But yeah, it makes things easier from a campaign finance and an optics perspective." Thompson and Myers are also facing their own sign-related complaint filed July 15th. The complaint, filed by Alex Logman, claimed that the pair of candidates had failed to disclose the full costs of signage or payments to a consulting firm whose number was included on the signs. It also alleged that the candidates had both received a handful of individual contributions in excess of the $220 individual donation limit. Logvin said he became interested in campaign finance as a result of a surprisingly fierce Salt River Project board election and started learning about laws regarding election-related signage. He's filed several complaints with both the Secretary of State and Clean Elections, including an additional complaint against Myers and Thompson with the SOS regarding the size of the disclosure text. The Corporation Commission, even though it should get more attention than it actually does, it's a relatively smaller race in the grand scheme of things, and I was just shocked by the sheer volume of signs for those two, Logvin said. In a response dated July 20th, Thompson and Myers dismissed the complaint as one in a pattern of retaliatory filings from Logvin submitted just a few days before the Republican primary on July 21st. That timing and the escalating severity of each successive filing built from the same handful of photographs is not the profile of someone raising a genuine compliance issue as it arises, they wrote. The missing expenditures had a simple explanation, they wrote. The signs referenced in the complaint were reused from the 2022 election. The phone number for the Resolute group included on the signs was out of date. Campaign finance shows 2022 payments to the consulting firm. The individual contributions were currently under review, they wrote, and if any are found to be in excess of early limits, a refund will be processed and a corrective amendment will be filed. Logvin said he had not yet seen the response. I'm not surprised they pushed back, Logvin said. I haven't had, in fact, of everything that I've submitted, I've had only one group reach out and be like, hey, we had no idea we were doing it wrong, we want to fix this. In January, a complaint was also filed against David Marshall, who planned to run with HEAP. The complaint alleged Marshall had inappropriately transferred funds from an old campaign account into his war chest for the Arizona Corporation Commission race. The complaint was closed in April when Marshall withdrew from the race to accept an appointment as the Navajo County Recorder. Through the state's Clean Elections program, candidates for Corporation Commission can qualify for $147,000 for the primary election and $222,000 for the general election in 2026. To qualify, candidates have to submit at least 1,500 qualifying $5 contributions. They're also subject to certain restrictions. Participating candidates can't take money from political action committees, and they're limited in the amount of small seed donations they can raise. Once qualified, a candidate cannot raise additional funding on their own. You're agreeing to amount limits, no large donations from individuals, and you're agreeing to overall limits on how much you can raise and spend before you qualify for financing, Collins said. This cycle, all five candidates qualified for public financing. Campaign finance complaints have to be sworn and notarized before being reviewed by staff. If accepted, staff will ask for a response. After an investigation, the five-member commission will rule on whether there's evidence of a violation, at which point penalties can be assessed. Meyer said he isn't heartbroken about the July 21st primary loss to Heap, but believes the fallout of an investigation and other fines or other censure could increase the chances that a Democrat takes one or both of the commission seats. I think what you're going to see with all of the hubbub is you're probably going to get a Democrat in that seat, Meyer said. You're listening to Hour One of today's Arizona Republic on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Jack Palmer, and we'll continue with an article titled "Fontas Rips Trump Over Aim to Limit Mail Voting," written by Stephanie Murray. Arizona Secretary of State Adrian Fontas slammed President Donald Trump for attempting a federal takeover of mail-in voting. The Trump administration is seeking the Supreme Court's approval to tighten rules for mail-in ballots ahead of the pivotal November midterm election. This is a federal takeover of a constitutional duty that the states have, not the White House, Fontas said in a video on X. As long as I'm the Secretary of State, I'm going to protect the rule of law and the Constitution, and I'm going to protect your right to vote by mail. States administer federal elections, but Trump has sought to expand federal control over voting in his second term through executive orders and by urging Congress to pass the Save America Act. The Trump administration filed an emergency appeal to the Supreme Court on July 27th when the Republican president's executive order to curtail mail-in voting was blocked by lower courts. 23 states, including Arizona, challenged the March order in court. As a result, the administration was thwarted from creating a federal list of eligible voters and limiting delivery of mail ballots only to people on that list in nearly half the states. A federal judge in June said key parts of the order were unconstitutional and ruled that those components could not be enforced in states challenging the order. A month later, an appeals court rejected the Trump administration's argument that the lawsuit was premature until the order was fully implemented. Fontas, a Democrat, called the Trump administration's latest appeal to the Supreme Court another attempt to try to pick their own voters and thwart our ability to vote by mail. Any change to mail-in voting could mark a major shift for Arizona, a battleground state where the majority of voters cast their ballots by mail. Trump has lost in court after court on this issue. He'll lose at the Supreme Court, too, Democratic Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays said on X. The next article is titled U.S. and Saudi Arabia Attack Iran-Linked Fighters in Iraq, written by Michael Loria and Natalie Nasa Alund. Saudi Arabia joined the United States in attacking fighters aligned with Iran, the country's Ministry of Defense announced July 29th. Saudi Arabia struck Iran-linked militias based in Iraq, it said. The strikes came in response to attacks from the militants on the oil and gas facilities in Saudi Arabia. Defense Ministry officials said the strikes were conducted in coordination with U.S. Central Command, the military arm overseeing operations in the Middle East. On the heels of a reported targeted attack on U.S. troops July 28th, President Donald Trump on July 29th vowed Iran was going to get a beating over Tehran's overnight attacks. The comment came during an interview with Fox News in which the president dropped expletives about how forces would respond to Iran, adding the United States would be hitting them hard. U.S. Central Command said Iran launched a series of ballistic missiles at a U.S. base in Jordan in what the agency called a surprise attack that day. All Iranian missiles were successfully intercepted, the agency wrote on X. The July 29th strikes, confirmed by Saudi officials, mark the country's first announced foray into the war since Trump and ally Israel launched on Iran on February 28th. This reaffirms the kingdom's legitimate right to defend itself and its capabilities, while reserving the right to respond at the appropriate time and place, in line with the Almighty's words, defense ministry officials said in a statement on X. Saudi forces conducted precise and targeted strikes against objectives belonging to those militias located on the territory of the Republic of Iraq and linked to the attacks on petroleum facilities in the kingdom. The U.S. Central Command confirmed the coordinated strikes with Saudi fighter jets, saying they targeted Iran-aligned terrorists in the eastern part of Iraq. According to military officials, the attacks came in response to Iran-directed attacks on U.S. assets in the region. They were the first U.S. airstrikes in the Middle East since July 24th. The unwarranted attacks against U.S. forces was not successful, Central Command said in a statement. The IRGC and its terrorist proxies must cease these attacks to avoid further U.S. military response. Central Command said there were 600 such attempted attacks on U.S. assets in the region in the first 2 months of the war. USA Today has reached out for more information on how many Iran-linked attacks on U.S. assets there have been since April. At least 18 U.S. service members have died in the war, and hundreds have been injured, according to officials. Fighting had resumed earlier in July after a U.S.-Iran interim deal reached in June collapsed over the fate of the Strait of Hormuz, a globally important energy shipping route which Iran says it controls. Oman most recently proposed a plan for joint regional control of the strait with the backing of Arab states that would allow the payment of voluntary service charges. But a senior Iranian official told Reuters on July 29th that Iran had rejected the Omani proposal as unreasonable. If you've missed any of these articles, you can always listen on demand by going to our website, sunsounds.org, click on Broadcast Info and Audio, and then On Demand. Our next article is titled, Senate Confirms Clayton to Lead Intelligence Agencies, written by Zach Anderson. The Senate confirmed U.S. Attorney Jay Clayton as Director of National Intelligence in a party-line vote, approving President Donald Trump's pick to permanently lead the nation's spy agencies. Clayton was confirmed July 28th by a 51-47 vote after months of turmoil around the office of the Director of National Intelligence. Jay is outstanding in every way and will do a spectacular job as director, Trump wrote on social media after the vote. Tulsi Gabbard announced in May that she was resigning as director, and Trump tapped housing official Bill Pulte to run the office on an interim basis, elevating a close ally with no experience in intelligence operations. Pulte faced bipartisan criticism on his qualifications for the intelligence job. While Clayton also has had relatively few national security credentials compared to his predecessors, he oversees the Justice Department's office in the Southern District of New York, which handles cases related to national security threats, and is the DOJ's largest field office with more than 220 prosecutors. He's also a former chair of the Securities and Exchange Commission. Clayton attracted attention during his confirmation hearing for refusing to say who won the 2020 election. Trump lost the 2020 race to former President Joe Biden, but has continued to push unfounded claims that the election was stolen. "I'm not going to engage in the theater," Clayton said when pressed by Senator John Ossoff, Democrat of Georgia, on the 2020 election. Senator Mark Warner, a Virginia Democrat who serves as vice chair of the Intelligence Committee, said in a news release after Clayton's confirmation that he was initially encouraged by his nomination, but came away from his confirmation process with serious reservations about whether he would be willing to stand up to political pressure when it matters most. "Now that he has been confirmed, I sincerely hope he proves those concerns unfounded, because the intelligence community deserves steadier leadership than it has received in recent months," Warner said. The next article is titled, "Attacks Signal New Escalation," written by Marwa Rashad, Mohammed Ez, Yasmin Ghania, and Nandita Bose. A drone hit a U.S.-owned gas storage tanker at Egypt's Mediterranean port of Damietta, British maritime security firm Ambry said in an initial assessment on July 29th, and U.S. Central Command said the United States conducted new airstrikes in Iran as the Middle East conflict appeared to expand beyond its main fronts. The U.S. strikes started at 8 p.m. Eastern Time on July 29th, Central Command said. The strikes are a powerful response to yesterday's attempted Iranian attacks on U.S. forces based in the Middle East, it said. Earlier, a statement from Egypt's petroleum ministry confirmed a fire at the port, but made no mention of a drone attack. It was not immediately clear who was responsible. The drone hit floating storage tanker Energos Winter, causing a fire that then spread to another vessel, three trading sources familiar with the incident said. The fire was dealt with immediately with no casualties, the petroleum ministry added. The incident, which President Donald Trump said he had been briefed on, came amid a sharp escalation in the conflict, with Iran firing missiles at U.S. forces in Jordan and the United States and Saudi Arabia striking Iran-backed armed groups in Iraq. Alongside Yemen's Houthi group declaring a naval blockade on Saudi Arabia, the latest exchanges suggest the conflict is spreading further than it has since the United States and Israel started bombing Iran in February. Trump earlier vowed to retaliate against Iran for firing on U.S. troops days after he halted airstrikes. "So it's our turn," Trump told reporters at the White House. He said Washington would see if there was an agreement with Iran at some point, but we're going to hit them very hard. Iran confirmed overnight that it had fired on U.S. bases in Jordan and at ships in the Strait of Hormuz, and also spurned an Omani proposal to jointly manage the strait. Trump had said operations against Iran would last only a few weeks when he launched them in February, but fighting has now gone on for 5 months with no end in sight. The joint U.S.-Saudi attacks also mark the first time Riyadh has publicly joined strikes alongside Washington. Iraq's popular mobilization forces, powerful Iran-backed paramilitary groups incorporated into the Iraqi security forces, said at least 20 members were killed and 32 wounded in U.S.-Saudi strikes targeting several bases across Iraq. Iraqi men shouted Shiite sectarian slogans and "Death to America" as they carried the bodies of slain fighters in body bags. Washington and Riyadh said they struck the Iran-backed armed groups in Iraq in retaliation for drone attacks on Saudi oil targets launched from Iraq. It was the first major U.S. military action in the Middle East since July 24th, when Trump abruptly suspended an intensive bombing campaign after 13 days. U.S. officials privately cautioned that resuming major combat operations against Iran would carry risk given the negative impact on stocks of munitions. The Center for Strategic and International Studies, a Washington-based think tank, estimated this week that the U.S. military has fewer than 1,000 Patriot Interceptor inventories and fewer than 250 THAAD interceptors, two key air defense systems. Though Iran denies its forces have directed strikes from Iraqi territory, Iranian newspaper Hamshahri reported that four Iranian Revolutionary Guard advisors had been killed in the strikes on Iraq. The strikes on Iraq expose a dangerous rift in that volatile country. The Shiite-led government is one of the few in the world to balance close military and diplomatic ties with both Tehran and Washington, but those divided loyalties are a constant source of tension and frequent domestic unrest. The office of Prime Minister Ali al-Zaidi, who took power just 2 months ago, urged the parties involved to avoid escalation and said he wanted to keep the country out of regional conflicts. The Iraqi presidency denounced the strikes on the paramilitaries as an unacceptable attack and a flagrant violation of Iraq's sovereignty, while also calling for a halt to attacks by armed groups against Iraq's neighbors. Hours before launching the joint attacks with Saudi Arabia on Iraq, the U.S. military said its air defenses had averted a surprise Iranian attack on U.S. troops in the region. Jordan's military said it had shot down 5 Iranian missiles. U.S. bases in Jordan have lately become primary Iranian targets, where 3 U.S. service members were killed this month in the worst U.S. losses since March. Iran said it fired several ballistic missiles at U.S. military installations in Jordan and had struck 3 tankers that were attempting to transit through the Strait of Hormuz along an unauthorized route. The next article is titled, Fed Opts to Hold Rates Steady, written by Ann Saphir and Michael Derby. The Federal Reserve held interest rates steady on July 29th, a choice that may intensify questions about how U.S. Central Bank Chief Kevin Warsh will deliver on his commitment to bring inflation back down to the 2% target. The widely expected decision to leave the benchmark interest rate in the 3.5% to 3.75% range drew dissents from 3 of the 12 members of the policy-setting Federal Open Market Committee, who preferred a quarter percentage rate hike at this meeting. Those same 3 officials, the presidents of the Fed's Cleveland, Dallas, and Minneapolis regional banks, had also dissented at Jerome Powell's final meeting as central bank chief in late April. In that case, they favored removing the implied promise of lower rates in the policy statements. Warsh, who took over as head of the Fed in May, has said he has no tolerance for inflation that has been running above the central bank's target for more than 5 years, and up until June was accelerating as the war in the Middle East pushed up global fuel and food prices, and investment in data centers and other spending tied to artificial intelligence drove up demand. Inflation remains elevated relative to the committee's 2% goal, the Fed said in a short policy statement after the end of its latest 2-day meeting. It replicated word for word all of the June 17th statement's assessment of the economy. The Fed noted that economic activity is expanding at a solid pace, saying, as it did in June, that job gains have kept pace with the workforce and the unemployment rate has changed little. Speaking at a news conference after the release of the policy decision, Warsh said, "We've begun a new chapter, and we understand that the 5-plus years of inflation above target cannot be cured in 9 weeks or by a single month of modest price decreases. This Fed will not waver on getting inflation back to the 2% target." And that's all the time we have for this hour of the Arizona Republic. I'm your broadcast volunteer, Jack Palmer. Stay tuned for the second hour of the Arizona Republic on Sun Sounds of Arizona.